Fanusi, I'm 46 years old. Today is Wednesday, May 26, 2021, and I am currently living in Columbia, Maryland, and having a conversation with my twin sister, Farida Abdul-Tawab Brown.
And I am Farida Abdul-Tawab Brown, 46 years old. Today is Wednesday, May 26, 2021. We're here in Columbia, Maryland, and I'm in conversation with my twin sister, Fatima Fanusi. With God's name, the merciful benefactor, the merciful redeemer.
And we were taught from the time we were very young to begin everything that we say and do with the name of God and with the attributes that he uses most often to describe himself. Ar-Rahman, which is the merciful benefactor, and Ar-Rahim, which is the merciful redeemer.
So we were born and raised in Boston, Fatima, and our parents were not. So let's talk about how they ended up in Boston, as it's pretty integral to our story.
Well, let me see. Mommy came to Boston to attend Northeastern, where she was studying education. And she was a person who was devoted and committed to education from the time that she was a little girl. Yeah. As a matter of fact, her childhood hero, instead of being a super hero, was actually Dr. Mary McLeod Bethune. And Daddy came to Boston because both of his parents were living in Newton, Massachusetts at the time.
Yes, because Granddaddy had started a new position with the Ecumenical Society of New England, correct? And that brought them there. And so I think it was their mutual interest in the Nation of Islam that brought them to Boston and brought them together, actually. Right?
It was. And that's pretty much the story and the narrative that we want to discuss today.
Yeah.
We think that we have a pretty unique heritage, and it's something we'd love to share with others about growing up as Muslim Americans.
Yeah. And so, of course, Mommy and Daddy met at Muhammad University of Islam, where they were both teachers. He was the dean of boys. She was the dean of girls. You know, one thing led to another, and they had mutual interests, and they were married in 1974. That was August, correct? August 74, which brings us to May 1975, which was our birth.
And what I like to call, I'm also a historian, the birth of an American Muslim identity.
Yeah. So
I think we had a pretty unique education and upbringing, and perhaps that's a good place to start.
Yeah, I think probably my earliest memories, Fatima, were growing up in kind of like the womb of our masjid, which began as temple number 11. But as they moved into al-Islam and understanding of the Quran, the name was changed to Masjid Muhammad and then Masjid al-Quran. But we kind of grew up in the masjid. Mommy was a school teacher. Daddy was the principal. And we went to the Sister Clara Muhammad School, which was actually the building next door. It was between our apartment house on Intervale Street and the masjid, which was at 35 Intervale Street. And so we ended up going to school in the community, literally.
Yeah, and because this is also the same time that you're literally seeing the formation and the establishment of institutions, Clara Muhammad School went from that small building next to that was a former home next to the masjid to, by the time we were in second and third grade, it was actually an old school building that the community, yes, and believers had purchased at, well, was it 150 Magnolia Street?
Yeah, it was the old Benedict Fenwick School.
Yes. And that school actually became an institution that really revolutionized the surrounding inner city urban neighborhoods,
yeah,
with children who were Muslim and children who were not attending the school.
And as a matter of fact, that's when our parents, remember, Mommy and Daddy purchased their home, like around the corner and up the hill from the school so that we could walk to school every day. And that was, you know, opening with the Pledge of Allegiance, you know, Surah Al-Fatiha, the first chapter of the Quran. And, you know, I remember our classes, we began with Miseducation of the Negro. We would copy chapters and discuss, you know, our education as young, establishing our identity as young people with the entire world at our fingertips as Americans.
Right. And I just want to go back and break down those three things that you said in one breath. I mean, let's think about that. So we started our school day with the Pledge of Allegiance, mm-hmm. reminding us that we were Americans. And then we immediately went into Al-Fatiha, which, like you said, is the opening chapter of the Quran. And then Miseducation of the Negro is a book by Carter G. Woodson, who's also the same historian responsible for starting Black History Month. It started out as a week in February and then was extended to the entire month. Yeah. Now, I have a love-hate relationship, or I did, with that book, because we were also assigned chapters from Miseducation of the Negro if we misbehaved.
Exactly.
And being the mischievous twin, I was often copying that entire book chapter by chapter after school.
Yin and yang, frickin' frack. That was us.
But let's talk about the language environment at Clara Muhammad School, because that is something that still shapes me to this day and that influences my parenting style and how I engage with the world.
Yeah. So do you remember, I remember one of the first things we learned was that man means mind and that woman is the womb of the mind. So we were always kind of focused in on our identity as creatures and servants of God, of the omnipotent, and that we were to use our intellect as men and women, boys and girls, to bring benefit to the entire society. That was my identity. It was also the word Khalifa, the Arabic word Khalifa, remember, where what means leadership. You know, we have responsibility, inherited responsibility. And we took that seriously even as 8 and 9 year olds. You remember?
And actually, Khalifa in the Quran, the context that it was introduced to us, is the chapter where God is telling the angels that he is going to make a Khalifa or a vicegerent, an inheritor, someone who will assume his responsibility in the earth for caring for the earth.
Yes.
And it might sound heavy and weighty to put on the shoulders of a 6-year-old or a 7-year-old, but it was actually something that kind of imbued me with a real sense of responsibility. I never felt, remember, this was a school where at the same time, I don't know how familiar people are to this day about the Nation of Islam, but this was a school where at the same time that we were learning this Quranic identity for ourselves as Muslim Americans, we also had a deep focus on our own history. The majority of the students and teachers at the school were African American.
Yes.
And remember, the school was open to everyone. Remember, Amine Amanpour attended, whose parents were from Iran and Norway. We had Sudanese friends. We had it was really a conglomerate.
Sister Tahmina,
who was Pakistani. But what was important is that we're learning our history in Africa. We're learning the history of the Middle Passage. We're learning the history of chattel slavery in America. But we always, we had this sense of being special and unique.
Well, you know what? I think now that you talk about like the Quran and our history as a people, I remember one of those moments. I think it was about the 3rd or 4th grade. And it was this, and of course, Daddy was reinforcing this at the dinner table, right? So it was this idea that we were like the children of Israel, you know, in scripture, that they came through a furnace of experience of oppression and slavery, and they were chosen by God to hold on to this covenant that would elevate them, you know, as long as they held on to that. And so our identity as an African American people was not to be ashamed of slavery, ashamed of that experience, but that we were a new people forged in this furnace. And that I never felt inferior. I never felt like anything but a person who was chosen by the Creator to be a leader on this earth.
Yeah. And learning, and remember, we were taught our history in really fun ways. I remember the Black History Contest that happened throughout the city, and we would always take first prize where we were drilled in. Remember, Daddy and Mommy purchased comic books that featured, you know, Matthew Henson, Mary McLeod Bethune, Muhammad Ali.
Three Musketeers, Dumas.
That featured famous Africans and African Americans throughout history. And that was a really fun way to learn our history, as was preparing for those Jeopardy-styled contests, you know, where we would scoop up. And then you know what else I think really went into our identity?
What?
This sense of ourselves as Bilalians. Remember?
Yes, Bilalian. So,
because remember, who was Bilal, you know?
So Bilal was an enslaved Abyssinian, or today that's known in the area known as Ethiopia. He was a slave, and he was one of the first Muslims, right? One of the first believers. And he was, Ahad. He was the first muezzin, the first caller to prayer, and his status was elevated among the Muslims because, as is today and as throughout history, there are always isms, racism and other things, but he was elevated by God and his messenger to call the people to prayer. And so our identity was that we were believers and we inherited the mantle of Bilal, hence Bilalia.
And I remember doing little skits and plays at Clara Muhammad School where we actually acted out those famous scenes from Bilal's life, where Bilal is lying on, as the story goes, Bilal has accepted Islam, unbeknownst to his masters, his slave owners.
So he's still enslaved at this
point. He's still enslaved. Yeah. And Prophet Muhammad, prayers and blessings be upon him, Bilal is one of the first people to accept Islam at a time when it's still a quiet, hidden movement. And somehow Bilal's master finds out and decides to torment and punish him. And the punishment ends with Bilal lying in the hot desert of Arabia. You know, this is back in, you know, the 600s. And with a huge rock on his chest. And this was a story that was vivid to us because at Clara Muhammad School, we would watch Muhammad the Messenger, a film starring Anthony Quinn. And we were also told the message. And we were also told this story. So we literally would enact and enact this. And someone would take be out on the school playground with the rock on your chest saying, Ahad, because each time they asked Bilal to renounce God, Allah being the one God, they would ask him to admit that the other gods that the Bedouin Arabs at that time in Mecca worship, he would each time, instead, it got to the point where he couldn't speak whole sentences. All he could say was Ahad, the word meaning one, meaning one God. So he refused to denounce. And of course, he was beaten until Abu Bakr comes and rescues him by purchasing his freedom. But that connected, we knew that we had this history in America from the beginning of its formation as a country, as a nation, as enslaved people who were often treated, you know, abused and oppressed. But this connected us not just with that history, but it also reminded us that we were a part of the formation of Islam, as both as oppressed people, as slaves or enslaved people, and as people coming from the African continent. So Imam Waris-ud-Din Muhammad, who was the son of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, and who also assumed leadership of the Nation of Islam in 1975, which is why we like to say that
we were born. We developed together, right?
with this American Muslim identity. But Imam Muhammad, it might have been during the 1980s, was it? But it was during our childhood, he decided that we should call ourselves Bilalians.
So, you know, interestingly enough, not only does that connect us with our specific African identity, but it also connects us with this identity that Bilal, his soul was not enslaved to a human being.
Ever.
And in the same way, we as African Americans have this identity that is not connected to those who oppressed us, but it was connected to our relationship with the Creator. But on that note, Fatima, that brings me to, you know, the whole idea of racism, like with CRADE, right? So there was the Committee to Remove All Images of the Divine. And CRADE. I remember it specifically as a child in the 80s. We'd be down at the Boston Commons marching with the other members of the community holding signs. And CRADE was an initiative to, of course, the acronym was Committee to Remove All Images of the Divine.
Well, it was Imam Waris-ud-Din Muhammad, actually, it was one of his initiatives. Yeah. And the goal actually was twofold. One, to get to offer Americans a way to heal from the disease of racism, which actually affected all Americans across socioeconomic, ethnic, racial, et cetera, origins. And then some of the more tangible material goals were to collect 10,000 signatures and to present them to the Pope in Rome at the Vatican. And Imam Muhammad was actually successful in achieving both of those goals through all of the believers, people like our dad and our mother who were in the CRADE movement. And what we did is, and when I say we, you and I were kids. Do you remember being there?
I do.
But the CRADE committee members would actually silently march, holding up big signs and posters asking about what the effect was for Americans and for any human beings to sit in and day out and see a depiction or image of God as a human being and in a specific racial or ethnic or identity.
I have to stop you there. Do you remember the song? I sit in church, and I don't understand.
Well, right? I was going to go into the song, but I just wanted to talk more about the method. What we did, remember, we would be outside of the business areas the financial areas, the financial districts at 8:30 in the morning when people were getting off to go to work, or at 5 when they were leaving. And most people would, and we would be silent. We wouldn't say anything. And they would read what was on the placards. And then if they agreed with the premise that seeing God depicted as a white person or a black person or any racialized image was harmful, then they would sign the petition. Mm. And instead of getting 10,000 signatures from Americans, we got over 100,000, a couple of 100,000. And indeed, Imam Muhammad actually did go to the Vatican and was probably the first Muslim in the modern era to be invited to speak at the Vatican. But yes, I remember that song. If you'll sing louder than I will, no. I would actually go into the lyrics.
We can just do the first. Because I sit in church, yet I don't
can't hold a tune.
Why we pray to a Caucasian man, his hair is blonde and his eyes are blue. Daddy, he doesn't look like you. They said he died above the cross. Then why is it that I feel so lost? They say his name is Jesus, you see, but he doesn't even look like me. What is this image I see?
Yeah, so there's like so many more.
Yes. Yes. Do these images portray divine, or is it a picture in my mind? Creed was a powerful movement. I'm glad you brought that up.
And then that last line was, he looks like the slave masters of long ago. So think about how that meant, you know, and it also brings us back to 75 because it was the birth of a community, but it also makes me feel so blessed that I wasn't raised with that imagery, that we were not, that we had this clear understanding that God cannot be depicted and is not limited to one ethnic group. And so that was liberating.
You know, and we took that for granted because it was all we knew. We were learning the lyrics to Creed when we were, 7 and 8 years old. Mm-hmm. But I didn't realize that it was something that I took for granted and that was so integral to our own identity formation until I was actually a PhD student at Howard University taking a seminar on civil rights in America. And on the first day of the class, I'll never forget, the professor said, I have a question. And these are largely, it's basically an African-American course with African-American students. And he said, put your hand up if at one time in your life, your image of God was of a white man. And everyone in the class slowly, some quickly, some slowly raised their hand, except for me. And so Dr. Arnold, he stops at my desk and he says, there's always one. And then he said, who is this? Muhammad Abdullah, what's your last name? And he looks at the roster. But I love to tell that anecdote to share it because in his experience, and he was on the threshold of retirement, I think he retired that year. So he was an elderly professor. But in his lived experience, every American, every African American associated God with a blonde-haired, blue-eyed human being, man. Yeah. And that image, but in his experience, at the same time, as he grew older, there were always a few people in his class who claimed that that wasn't their reality. Mm-hmm. And then he said, Muhammad Abdullah, meaning that for him, most of these people were Muslims. Yeah. So I think that gets right to one of the things that we took for granted, but that was never a part of our own cultural formation.
So, and that's interesting because for you, that, you know, that resonated with you in that doctoral experience. But for me, it was when we left Clara Muhammad School and we went to Boston Latin Academy and we were in this, you know, for the first time, we kind of left the womb of our home and community and we went out into the larger society. And I think we adjusted pretty well.
But can you do you remember what that womb was? How comprehensive it was?
Yeah, I mean, we had literally we lived down the street from the masjid or down the street from the school our entire lives. So we had like Heart Halal, which was the halal meat market, which was owned by
Gucci, convert to Islam, yeah,
Brother Calvin. Brother Calvin
and Brother Metatosh.
An Iranian
who had fled the Iran-Iraq War.
And the
Ensemble One Day Camp.
Brother Mustafa.
Yeah, yes. So our summer camp, our tap jazz ballet run by Shay Majid.
Yes.
I mean, we had this entire comprehensive world that was not closed to anyone.
Yes.
The residents of the neighborhood could come. Remember the street festivals, the bazaars.
Movie nights with Brother Aleph.
Hanging out at Delight Restaurant, which serves all halal food. And this is in the late 1980s and 90s, y'all.
Yeah. Yes, Blue Hill Lab. It was right down the street from Grove Hall, the Grove Hall neighborhood, which, kind of became, even
now today it's flourishing. It's a Mecca. Hub.
It's a But back to where you were saying.
Yeah. No. I mean, of course, you know, we had our challenges as young adults, you know, leaving this kind of, you know, protected environment, this womb, right? Where we were supported in developing our identity, and we went to this larger environment. And I remember talking, meeting friends and other people as we went to, you know, through ancient history class, American history classes, where I was meeting other African Americans in particular who didn't want to talk about the legacy of slavery. They somehow felt inferior. They didn't. And this was new to me, right? Like, I never experienced that. I was proud of our identity, not just, you know, in general, but also our history of, you know, our parents. Our mommy was raised by her grandmother, Gigi, our great grandmother, who was a product of, you know, the movement of education that strove to give practical and life skills as well as intellectual education.
Born in town
in New Jersey. And then Daddy, of course, was the grandson of Hattie Paramore, who was great grandson of Hattie Paramore.
I think we should tell the story of Hattie Paramore.
Yes, well, you tell it.
Hattie Paramore was the grandchild of slaves, former slaves, and she actually built the first school building in Quincy, Florida, but it was burnt down, and it was burnt down by racists. And then she and her sons rebuilt the building, and it was burnt down again. And I think that happened two or three times until finally the townspeople of Quincy, many of them who were Caucasian Americans, got together and raised the money to purchase bricks. And then Hattie Paramore with her children and the townspeople rebuilt that school so that it couldn't be burned down. Mm. And these were the things that we heard around the dinner table from the time we were growing up. So we kind of had this sense of...
And we had, and you were always the Buffalo Soldier, right? You had, that's what we used to call, you had this indomitable spirit. And it was like Granddaddy. Remember, we always heard the tale of Granddaddy after he left FAMU, Florida A&M University, and he rode the trains.
Like a hobo,
Yes, with his best friend up to the north, up to D.C. to attend Howard University. Of course, he traveled with his friend who died in his arms of tuberculosis. But that was the kind of spirit that kind of informed our genetic makeup and our cultural and ethnic
identity. And you know what else I think made attending Boston Latin Academy, where we were students from 7th to 12th grade, you know what else made that such a shock? Now that I think about Clara Muhammad School, do you remember the other thing that, in addition to miseducation of the Negro in the books, another part
up
of our, and Up from Slavery, Booker T. Washington, we also had to watch the Eyes on the Prize series.
Yeah.
Remember?
I know the one thing I did right was the day I started to fight. Keep your eyes on the prize.
Hold on. Henry Hampton's Eyes on the the Prize film series documented the civil rights movement in 1 hour segments and aired on PBS. And we watched that again and again.
Year.
So we felt we had lived through not just the big moments that everyone knew, the defining moments like the March on Washington, but the smaller moments, the behind the scenes, the meetings, the rallies that really got that whole engine going and that made the civil rights movement a movement not just of African Americans, but of their allies across religious, racial, and ethnic boundaries.
Yeah, yeah. So that was something we lived.
Going back to Latin Academy, arriving there as 12-year-olds in the seventh grade, I think that some of our shock was because of how I remember thinking, for me, that I had another moment, and it was when I was a TA for Dr. Gerald Gill at Tufts University. Okay. It was the first year of my master's program, and Dr. Jerry Gill's seminar, African Americans until 1865 and African Americans from 1865 until the present was basically this seminar that beautifully retold the narrative of American history through the experience and lenses of African Americans. Yeah. And I remember thinking, not only does this buttress everything we've learned all of our lives, but this should be a required course for every American, you know, along with learning the Pledge of Allegiance.
Yeah.
But I think that for us, when we got to Latin Academy, even though we had so many challenges, I recall this impacting our identity as Muslims, Americans, in a different way. For one, we were now ambassadors of our faith.
Yeah.
There were some people who had never heard of Muslims.
Yeah,
you know?
I remember when we were first there and we were, I think it was eighth grade, and I remember wearing a scarf. And I remember this a kid from our class, he he snatched my scarf off my head.
That happened to me too.
Yeah, I know. Well, we had pretty different responses to it. But
what was your response?
Well, you know, it was more like education. I was like, well, why? He called me a towel head or something like that. And I was like, actually, this isn't a towel. It's a scarf. And I kind of schooled him a little bit. But you also had that experience.
Mark Ciavola, eighth grade. We were supposed to be watching Romeo and Juliet because that was a show every year at Latin Academy. Remember, we had to read one book of Shakespeare. Yes. In eighth grade, it was Romeo and Juliet. And we were supposed to be watching it. And Mark Ciavola walks by and snatches my scarf off. My response was automatic. Maybe I'm more violent prone. No. I just turned around and slapped him across his face so hard that his face turned red. And I remember Mrs. Kane, our English teacher, just didn't even say anything. She just, but talking about covering our hair reminds me of some of the other challenges.
Yeah. It was challenging.
Trying to fit in.
We loved who we were, but then it's a challenge. You know, you're an adolescent, you're trying to fit in. And so there came a point when we decided, I don't want to stand out. I want to be cute. I want to be attractive. And
I don't want to seem so. And for me, I remember we did what was called de-jabbing. But I remember for me, it wasn't so much about covering my hair or being a Muslim. Now that I think about it, now that we've unpacked all those other things that went into our unique background, I think it was just that we were so different.
Yeah.
I remember coming home during my college years and reading my diary from seventh grade, and I cried for that girl. She was literally saying, I don't fit in. I'm so weird. I don't even recognize. Basically, I was having experiencing culture shock.
Yeah.
But this reminds me of the moment that we de-jabbed. And a friend of ours coined that term. Remember Saad, de-jabbing? And de-jabbing is basically just referring to wearing the hijab when you leave the house as your parents expect you to. And then the minute you turn that corner, taking that hijab off.
So we're like walking down the street past Fenway Park on our way to school.
And we've de-jabbed.
Yes, and so.
But we forgot our lunches and our music instruments. Remember? Okay. So what happened?
Yeah, so daddy and mommy drove by to drop it off at the school. They saw us. Mommy wanted to immediately confront us. And daddy was like, no, chill, we've got this. So when we got home.
No, but daddy just walked up to us, gave us our allowance, which we had forgotten, gave us our instruments, which we had forgotten, and gave us our lunch. And he didn't say anything else to us. And I remember being so afraid that entire school day.
Yeah.
My palms were clammy. My underarms were sweating. And I was like, what in the world is going to happen to us when we get home? But do you remember what daddy's response was?
I do.
It stands out.
To this day,
and it has really
shaped me. Standing in the front hallway by our doors. I remember that moment. And
he said, I don't ever want my children to be hypocrites.
Yeah.
You don't have to cover your hair. I remember he said, hair is dead matter. Mm-hmm. That is not what's important. And he said, the most important hijab or covering is the hijab or covering of taqwa, which is righteousness and God-fearing, God-consciousness, being aware of God with everything you see
and say. Regardful. And
regardfulness.
Yes.
And he said, and all Muslims, whether they're men or women, should be wearing the hijab of taqwa.
Yeah.
So he told us, do like your Pakistani sisters do with the salwar kameez and the hijab around their neck, or put it in your purse.
Yeah, so
just
you're
have
always
it available
ready
so that you're always ready for prayer.
Yeah.
But from that moment on, we were not forced to cover our hair.
Yeah.
And I think there was wisdom in that.
A lot of wisdom, I think. And I remember, you know, of fast forwarding a few years to college, like to the end of my college career, when I made the decision to, for me, I went through a lot of phases, but then as, you know, I went through my natural hair phase and everything and growing our hair out. And then I realized that I wanted to cover my hair as an indication for myself of an inner transformation that I was going through in terms of embracing Islam for myself, not because this is how I grew up or not because, you know, of what mommy and daddy taught me, but because this is what I wanted as a Muslim woman.
Right. Yeah. You know, I had a seminal or defining moment like that too, as a young Muslim. For me, when I went to Lincoln University, our freshman year of college, that was, I kind of liken it to being, what do they say? The preacher's kid, the preacher kid goes wild. I couldn't believe the unrestrained, what I thought was freedom at the time. And I had forgotten about those childhood elementary lessons that freedom. Remember, Ibn Muhammad was actually freedom or free mind.
Yeah, free
the
mind.
Freedom to think, to assume the responsibility of the inheritor, the mantle of Khalifa, which is the vicegerent of the creator.
Because that's going against the stream, though, because that's not what freedom was presented as. You know,
so I kind of went a little buck wild that freshman year and even that sophomore year. But a seminal moment for me was the summer after my sophomore year. I was planning to study a year abroad in Cairo, Egypt, and to make sure that I had money for the plane ticket and pocket money. I think I was working 3, maybe 4 jobs as a lifeguard. As the aquatics director at Cedar Hill, the Girl Scout day camp in and then I was working as a lifeguard at Wellbridge. Yeah, Waltham. I at the YMCA. I was just going from job to job to job. And I had one day off, I remember, and Daddy and I were hanging out in Cambridge. And we were on Mass Ave, and we realized that the time to pray had come in. Mm-hmm. So we took a detour on Prospect Street, which is where at that time, the Islamic Society of Boston, when it was still in a house, remember it was in that house? Mm-hmm. That's where it was.
Yes, I did.
So we went in to pray, and, you know, I had on like a short sleeve shirt, and my hair was uncovered. So I had to borrow hijab to put on my hair, my covering for my head. And I had to put on a long sleeve. I had to put on long sleeves to pray. And after I prayed, I remember coming out and there were a group of, you know, probably college sophomores, you know, juniors around my age. And they were dressed recognizably as Muslims. And I remember wanting to identify and connect with them immediately. But it was less their physical appearance and more what they were talking about that struck something deep within me. They were talking about Islamic education. And they were talking about how there was a dearth, how there weren't Muslim schools. And remember, Mommy and Daddy had actually established that first school, the Clara Muhammad School, that we attended. But it had long since shut down.
Yeah.
And they were talking about what they could do as university students at the area. You know, they were coming from, you know, Harvard and BU and Northeastern, and what they could do to really make sure that a school got up and running, a full-time school. And it took me back to dinner tables around our parents, you know, table. And remember all the meetings they would have, and they would have people, you know, just there every night as they worked on the school. And we as kids would be a part of that. So it kind of, it struck something deep within me, because for me, Muslim, being Muslim, Islamic, that was a part of my identity, but it wasn't a religious experience in the sense that we think of religion as being separate.
Yeah.
And I'm so glad that we started out by talking about Khalifa and man being mind and woman being the womb of mind. So woman being both a mind, but then also the womb that nurtures mind. And how that used to be my tied to my identity, my responsibility, and my mission in life. And so that's what kind of, so by the time I reconnected with Daddy outside of the masjid, we're walking down the street hand in hand, but I really wasn't the same girl who had walked in. And I kind of get teary whenever I think about this. But by the time we got to the end of the next block on Prospect Street, you know, heading back toward Mass Ave, I had tears streaming down my face. And Daddy just stopped and he was like, Fatima, you know, what's the matter? And I told him what was happening inside internally. And he just got so quiet. And for a while, I thought he wasn't going to respond. And then he said in a very like serious tone, Fatima, it's no coincidence that we are standing on Prospect Street. That is an ayatollah, a sign of God. And you are at a junction, an important crossroad in your life. There are many paths ahead of you. And which path you choose is up to you. So Daddy didn't know it at the time. But at that moment, I silently said the shahadatain to myself, which is just in Arabic, it's...
Yeah, ashadu an la ilaha illallah wa ashadu anna Muhammadur Rasulullah.
And that just means
I bear witness
there is no God except for Allah, or the one creator, and that Muhammad is his messenger. And so, and that was a very defining moment. That was a moment for me when I chose to live my life as a Muslim American, as a Muslim woman, as a Muslim African American, and all that entailed.
Yeah, and that for me, interestingly enough, around the same time, it was a slightly different episode, but it was meeting my future husband, you know, James Brown.
Yeah.
but anyway, you know, I. It, I was having a struggle. You know, I wanted to do the Peace Corps, I wanted to do grad school. And I remember talking, you know, to mommy and daddy, and, you know, he said something interesting, and I was, you know, I had professors who were encouraging me to do different things. And he was saying, basically, you know, there's, the world has a plan for you, and that will be to table your fertility and marriage and everything else until you finished, you know, maybe your doctorate or something else, and get your work experience and then get married. Or you can follow God's plan. And if he's bringing someone into your life, then maybe you should follow that plan. And I thought about that for a while. And
we were still in college, right?
We were still in college. Yeah. He proposed. And as you know, well, no, you know, we got married a year after we graduated from college. But I struggled with that for a long time because, you know, we had our first child, Zuleika, about a year and a few months after we were married. And, you know, I ultimately made the decision to homeschool her. But I always felt like I had to justify my decision to spend time with my children because I was an educated woman and I had all these other pursuits that I wanted to follow. But one of the things that I remember both daddy and other Muslim women saying to us was this idea that there are seasons in life, and that if you follow the things that are natural in the path, that you have plenty of time to use your intellect and your skills that God granted you to benefit the world. Yeah. And I may have struggled with it over the years, but I have not regretted that decision to get married out of school ever, not once.
Actually, I don't think we had intended to talk about this, but if you hadn't made that decision, I don't think that we would have this Quranic-based curriculum that our middle school daughters are about to go into in the fall, put together by us, where whether it's mathematics, whether it's you know, teaching literacy to children in Nigeria or feeding people in Baltimore, whatever it is, the entire curriculum is infused with not just Quranic principles, but what I like to call scriptural principles, the same principles that resonate across every religious tradition because they have all emanated from the one creator above us, whether you're a Hindu or Baha'i or Christian or, you know,
Zoroastrian,
you know, Jewish. So, I too am grateful for that.
Yeah.
And I guess if we had to wrap up, the other one thing I want to touch on is just how we were affected or weren't affected in that post 9/11 moment.
Yes. So do you remember there was, it's now called the Muslim Journal, but the newspaper that we had in our community that was, it started out as what, Muhammad Speaks? And
it was Muhammad Speaks during the Nation of Islam under the honor of Elijah Muhammad.
Yeah.
And then it became Bilalian News. Yeah. And then it became the Muslim Journal.
Yeah. So I remember this picture of Imam Waruthuddin Muhammad on the cover, and he's holding the American flag and he's like marching across. I don't know what the setting was, but, you know, of course we mentioned the Pledge of Allegiance and it was a masjid. Yes. So it was this idea that we are American, you know, our entire experience has birthed us in this place, in this, with its history, the good, the bad, the ugly, and the beautiful. And this was something that we were raised with, and we never felt that there was any kind of dissonance between our identity as Muslims and our identity as Americans.
And African Americans.
And African Americans.
Yes.
And however, you know, whether it was bean pie, my sister, you know, or, you know, to all of these kind of cultural nomenclature that you find in urban America and that kind of thing. But that wasn't the way a lot of other Muslims approached their existence in this nation.
Yeah.
And so, of course, I remember Imam Muhammad
getting a duality and a sense of conflict.
Yes, between our American identity and Muslim identity. Not for us, but for a lot of other Muslims.
Whose parents had immigrated or they had immigrated. And I think 9/11 was the moment where many of them started to make the effort to resolve that tension.
Yes. Well, they had to. You know, we were facing a situation where there were terrorists who attacked our nation, and then we were left holding the bag as Muslims to explain this awful behavior and then to identify where does your identity lie. And for us as Muslim Americans, in the experience that we had, that never was a dichotomy. We always were Muslim Americans. But I think that people started to follow, other Muslims started to follow that lead and become engaged more civically, you know, with government and
and running for office and things.
It's that funny that you say that, because I remember when Imam Waruthuddin Muhammad spoke, was it on the floor of Congress, was it the Senate?
Yeah,
he opened up with a prayer, and many Muslims, whether they were Saudi or Pakistani, started to automatically call him a disbeliever or a hypocrite for doing that with the United States government.
Yeah.
But how times have changed. Now Muslims are, and I remember people saying, oh, you know, in a kind of pejorative way, oh, are you a Waruthuddini?
Yeah.
You know, if you happen to, you know, celebrate the 4th of July or something like that. But yes, I am a Muslim. And I think that last little bit of tension is, and this is something a lot of Americans don't know, many Americans, and not just Americans, a lot of Muslims don't know, is that many Muslims assume that you had the Nation of Islam, which was a proto-Islamic movement that was not Islamic to its core. And then in 1975, when Imam Muhammad took over, he brought the largest contingent of Americans born in this country into Islam proper.
Yeah.
Many people mistake that transition for the birth of Sunni Islam.
Yeah, no.
But we never grew up identifying ourselves as Sunni Muslims.
Yeah, yeah.
We grew up identifying ourselves as Muslims whose behavior and whose lives were lived in accordance with the Quran and the Sunnah or example of Muhammad the Prophet.
Do you remember back at CMS, we would say, like when we were doing Arabic classes, I remember, Ana Muslima. And a Muslim. So I remember it was never...
Our identity was as Muslims and we were Americans.
Yes.
And
so it's interestingly enough, speaking of being Americans, like I remember, do you remember our I'm kind of going to like the holiday question now. Do you remember our house getting egged because mommy and daddy would give out raisins on Halloween? You know, like we were trying to give out healthy things. You know, the house got egged. We're like, we want to dress up and do all
and we had to clean up the eggs.
Yeah, of course. And then, you know, to our family, like the rest of our extended family, they're all Christian. So we go to our aunt and uncle's home for Christmas, you know, after Christmas celebration when our grandparents would come up from Florida. So we'd go to their home the week following Christmas and we, you know, we'd be in the house and we'd be talking about holidays. But that brings us to the celebration of the Eid. You know, there are two Eids in Islam, right? So Eid al-Fitr, which is after Ramadan, which we just finished, and Eid al-Adha, which is the larger Eid, which is during the Hajj or the pilgrimage to Mecca. And I remember, you know, mommy and daddy being part of like the Eid committee and establishing these big festivals and celebrations for us. But that brings us to the last Eid that we just had. I guess we're coming out of this pandemic, right? But it was in my backyard. And, you know, it kind of reminded me of how we grew up, you know,
that community life. And I think the pandemic gave us an opportunity to go back to that community life because now there are so many masjid or mosque masjids all over that have been established by Muslims with, you know, whose parents or grandparents have come from throughout the Muslim world. And so many Muslims have started to do their celebrations in these institutions. But because of the pandemic, you know, actually prior to the pandemic, we started Mercy Muslims, which is Mercy Muslims is designed to get back to the heart of what, not just Islam, but what Christ Jesus brought, what Moses, Musa alayhi as-salam, what Zoroaster, what all of the prophets of God brought, which is a reminder that we are supposed to be living and treating our brother and sister as we would want to be treated ourselves. Yeah. So Mercy Muslim is, sometimes when we institutionalize our religions, they get bogged down with all of our flaws as human beings, and that will happen with us too. Yeah. But Mercy Muslims was a reminder to go back to that core.
Yeah.
And so we had it in your backyard.
Yeah. And also just about Mercy Muslims, what you're reminding me of is that name that we began with, Ar-Rahman.
Ar-Rahman.
Or God, like the name that he describes himself by the most is coming from that root, Rahma, right? Meaning Arham, meaning womb. You know, we went from these wombs one to another. But this mercy that will allow us to touch each other in a way that our hearts are opened to not only God's mercy, but to how we interact with one another. And that backyard.
We had our Trinidadian Muslims from Brooklyn. We had our Nigerian Muslim sisters. The kids were jumping up and down on the trampoline while the talk was given. And then we did after the Eid prayer. We had food from all around the world.
Oh my goodness. And then our friend who's from the South, Savannah, she put her foot in some shrimp and grits and halal sausage.
But I think that he beautifully captured what it is to be Muslim and American today.
Do you remember the pinata? You got the pinata, the crescent, the star and crescent.
Oh yeah, which was I purchased from an African American Muslim online who drove from Virginia to deliver it, and it was a crescent moon, and the kids went crazy.
Oh my goodness! Of course they did the requisite dive for all the candy when it came out, but. It was just joy. It was connection again.
With children who were third generation Muslims.
Yes.
And who are quintessentially and beautifully Muslim and American.
Yeah.
And I think that our personal narrative really illustrates some of the journey of how Islam came to be established as an American religion.
Yeah.
And I hope more people, you know, would actually come to know about our narrative.
Yeah. And you know, interestingly enough, that takes me back to 1975, because remember, mommy and daddy didn't know they were having twins, right? So like, and we always like, you know, go back and forth about this story, because, you know, this is of course before the age of high tech ultrasounds and things of that nature. But what was it? Your heart was covering mine, or
we were cradled in the fetal position, and one of our heartbeats, I don't know whose, was covering the others.
Yeah.
So they got to the hospital with just one car seat, just one set of baby's clothing, and they didn't know that you were coming.
Yeah.
And then after I was born, the doctor said, wait, there's something else. There's someone
and then
else.
They had to put mommy under, right? And then they had to reach in. I was breech as well.
Yeah.
So the doctor was like old school, reached in, turned me around, and, you know, and I was born, of course. And they had to prepare for something that was unknown.
So they weren't prepared for two. And they didn't have names for us either.
That's right.
And so on our certificate, we're baby girl number one.
Female child number
and
one.
Baby girl number two. And it was kind of like the joke among Muslim kids. Clifford Aziz used to call us that all from high school.
Yep.
Baby girl number one and baby girl number two.
Yes.
But the reason I think that story is also timely and relevant here is we were also the first twins and maybe the first children to be named by Imam Warthin Muhammad under his leadership. He assumed leadership in February when the Honorable Elijah Muhammad passed, and then we were born a few months later in May.
Yeah.
And so I love to say that our actual life is synonymous with or parallel to the formation of a distinctly American Muslim identity and culture.
So I would say like 46 years in, I think that one of the things that I've learned, an epiphany I had, is that we're still kind of in that pioneering stage. You know, like sometimes we have a tendency, whether you're an immigrant, you see yourself as second generation, or you're the children of people who are establishing a certain cultural reality, we're still in the pioneering stage. We still have work to do to establish. And I love that you brought up like the educational initiative. We've inheriting that mantle one way or another from our grandparents, our great grandparents, our great grandparents, to educate, to liberate minds, and to help all children, you know, and all human beings see that their destiny and their reality and their identity.
We gotta be.
I gotta be. What you made me to be, there's nothing else I would rather be. Look into my eyes, tell me what you see. Your future self, it resides in me. So that was Russell, and
And I think that's the story. I think that's
All right.
our narrative.
All right. Peace, Twinnie.